Hello again, and welcome to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love to talk about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me, as always, will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. Today, we talk about Jean-Pierre Melville's 1970 French neo-noir classic, Le Cercle Rouge. That's the new intro right there.
That's pretty good, just a little bit less smarmy.
Awesome. I really missed you.
I missed you too, man.
So, hello, Cesar. Welcome.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah. It's been a long time. We have not recorded an episode for a really long time.
Yeah, what was
since
the last
I moved episode? To California. So it's been months.
April or May?
I think it was end of April we recorded, and May I moved.
Yeah.
So
what was the last one that we recorded? I can't even remember.
Was it Logan?
I don't know.
No, it was after Logan.
Did we do an episode on Logan? I don't know.
We did. You don't remember that?
A whole episode?
Yeah. And Maltese Falcon was the last one.
Okay, see, there you go. I think we talked about Logan, but that wasn't the episode, right? So.
No, we did a whole episode on Logan. Wait, I'm gonna look. I am 99% sure. Okay. We started with The Hustler. That was episode one. Sorcerer. Dog Day Afternoon. Inception. Tombstone.
Seven Samurai.
Hot Fuzz. Seven Samurai. The Shining. Children of Men, Logan, and the Maltese Falcon.
So, man, this, what a great run of films.
This is episode 12. We made it to a dozen.
Ugh, not quite teens.
No. We did chit-chat a little bit before starting the episode, but, you know, what have you been up to? Have you seen anything good recently?
Trying to stay busy. September was a pretty busy month, so I definitely did not get as much film watching in as I would have liked, but
yeah, you know, we've been trying to get this episode together for quite a while, actually. So
yeah, no kidding. It's been a trying couple of weeks, I guess. So yeah. Plus, you know,
it's okay, man. This is, you know, personal stuff, and making your livelihood working and stuff has got to come first. So
yeah,
you know, I enjoy talking to you. It's one of the great pleasures, Cesar, but you got to take care of number one first.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you know, and thank you and everyone else if you still are interested enough in listening to this, that you're stuck with us despite like our pretty massive hiatus.
Yeah, they're not, but that's okay. We'll build it back up.
You two guys out there, thanks.
We're certainly not going to gain a bigger audience of people by doing French crime films from the 70s.
Yeah, so. You're probably right.
At least not with the crowd we normally run with.
Okay, well, I guess if we're talking about films we just saw, I watched a number of movies recently. Probably the one film I'm going to decide to talk about amongst like maybe like the last 10. In the past couple weeks, I watched Hirokazu Koreeda's I Wish for the very first time. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Am not.
Okay. It's a 2012 film. Koreeda, he's got a couple of films in the Criterion Edition where our episode is Le Cercle Rouge, but Koreeda has done, he did films called, he's probably most well known for Nobody Knows, but okay. He has other films like Still Walking, which is a Criterion Collection picture. He's kind of like he's a master of dramatic film. If I were to select one person who's a modern working director, he's probably the closest to like Yasujiro Ozu in terms of like importance and film technique.
Okay, yeah, Ozu's absolutely, big, definitely.
Absolutely excellent film. I Wish is basically about a pair of two brothers. Who in the film are played by real brothers. We're talking like elementary school kids whose parents separate. So they move to opposite sides of Kyushu, the island of Japan, and they spend their time in the evenings talking to each other on their phone. They hear, you know, they live their lives as kids, and they have their own circle of friends, but they both miss each other, like, a lot. They hear a rumor that a bullet train is going to be installed between their two cities. So a rumor begins that when the two bullet trains pass each other at the same time, the energy gives a chance to make a wish. So, you know, as adults, like, it doesn't mean anything. It probably doesn't mean anything. But for these kids, it's a pretty serious opportunity. So they begin about making plans, each with their own separate group of friends, to meet in Kumamoto, where the trains are going to pass each other.
Did you review this on Film Smash?
I haven't. Not yet. I did write a review for it, but it hasn't popped up yet, though.
Okay, because this sounds familiar, like I read something about this already. But go ahead.
It's a fairly recent film, and the director, you know, he's of no small reputation, so I'm sure you probably read about it somewhere in the passing. But it's absolutely excellent film, beautiful. The kids are absolutely terrific. There's a hell of a lot of heart in the film that, kind of pushed it. It's one of his more populist films, and I could definitely see, I mean, the emphasis on the children, on the child actors, probably makes it a lot easier for people to, a wider audience to enjoy it, as opposed to, like, his generally pretty heavy and slow-moving family dramas. But, like, I totally recommend it. Absolutely terrific film.
Cool. Today we're going to be talking about Le Cirque Rouge, which is a movie that you picked, which is funny because it's really, like, it's totally in my wheelhouse, but you ended up picking this movie.
Oh, well, you know, I'm a big Melville fan. I think probably it's been over 10 years now since I've watched, since I first watched Le Samurai. I'm pretty excited that they're finally going to be releasing a Blu-ray for it, so I'll have
Is that November?
I think so. I can't remember. It was on their last kind of, like, announcement. So I think it's for November. Usually they only announce stuff 3 or 4 months in advance. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, before we talk about the actual movie, maybe we should actually, you know, like, for anybody out there. Well, first of all, you know, I guess spoiler alert. Here's a reminder about spoilers, guys. We're going to talk specifics. So if you haven't seen Le Cirque Rouge yet, stop right now and watch it. You can find the film on Blu-ray from Criterion, which is how I watched it. And I think that's how you watched it too, right?
It is. I've owned the Blu-ray for a few years now, and I figured this was a good opportunity for me to crack the seal on it.
Absolutely. I can't wait to hear your thoughts. It's also on Filmstruck for anybody that has a Filmstruck subscription. And Filmstruck actually has 6 other Melville flicks available right now to watch, including Le Samurai, which is awesome.
Oh, yeah? So I guess right now that's the only way to, if you wanted to watch it HD right now, that's the only way to watch it.
Yeah. Okay. Also, I did double check last night, and if you don't have Filmstruck and you don't want to go spend $40 or $50 on a Blu-ray outside of the half-price sale that Criterion always runs, Amazon has it for rental as little as $1.99 for standard definition, and I think it's $4.99 for HD. So if you want to spend a couple of bucks to watch it before you listen, stop the podcast right now. We will still be here. iTunes won't drop us, and we're paid up on Podbean for the next, like, 8 or 9 months, so I think we're good there. So if you're still with us, just be warned, we're gonna dive into it. So, but what should people expect? If they've never seen a French crime movie, you know, how is it different than an American crime film typically? Or in your case, being an expert on Asian cinema, how would it be different from something like that?
Well, I think it really depends on, like, for Asian cinema, there's different kind of, the different countries all can exhibit different styles. French crime.
And thank God.
Yeah. French crime specifically, with this film, I think is a good example of, like, how much they take their time. There's a lot of quiet that exists in these films. Mm-hmm. But it's all, at the same time, it is like kind of gritty and dirty. Like the underworld isn't necessarily dirty as in like actual filth, but it's dirty as in like it's the underworld feels like a totally different place you could visit. It's almost tangible.
Sure. You know, Melville came out of the tradition of 1950s French cinema. He was not part of the New Wave, which is probably the most famous French movement in film, when critics from Cahiers du Cinéma ended up taking up cameras and hiring actors and making their own movies. And you got people like François Truffaut, who became a superstar as a result of that. And they ushered in a whole new era of realistic documentary style, character driven films, which was sort of the antithesis of what was going on in 1950s French cinema, where more plot driven films, more classical styling was the deal. Melville built his reputation on crime films. In particular, there are few exceptions, but out of the 13 movies he made, at least 7 or 8 of them are straight, cool, understated crime pictures. And that comes right from the 1950s. The big French filmmakers were making movies that were influenced by the movies they loved from Hollywood of the 1930s and 1940s, stuff like the Warner Brothers gangster pictures, and of course, what would go on to be termed film noir. A high percentage of French cinema was considered policier during the 1950s, which was their own movement of crime pictures that took place before the New Wave. So Melville is certainly the guy that had the most success and the best longevity. And I think a lot of that had to do with he didn't get torn to shreds by the New Wave criticism. People like Truffaut respected Melville. He was an independent filmmaker. His body of work was auteur-driven. And you know, he basically owned his own studio. So a little bit of background on Melville. I don't know if you knew this. His real name was Jean-Pierre Grumbach, and he fought with the resistance during World War II. And as a result of that, he changed his name so that they wouldn't know his real identity. And he took the name Melville from author Herman Melville, who was one of his favorites, or so the story goes.
Yeah, I've heard that story, but you know, when you they really, it doesn't matter who you are. If you hear Melville, you automatically think of like Herman Melville. I think so.
Yeah. Absolutely. But yeah, he was able to make films, successful, popular films, featuring, you know, cool, professional criminals, much longer and with much better success than some of his 1950s contemporaries, through that new wave era.
Le Cercle Rouge, if I remember right, was probably one of his most financially successful films, yeah?
And his penultimate. He only made one movie after this, which was a movie that he sort of disowned, which it is on Filmstruck now. If you watch Filmstruck, it's Un Flic. Un Flic. I took 2 years of French in high school, but that was a long time ago, and I'm still going to butcher these names, so please forgive me.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to give it the old college effort as well.
Well, so. You're usually better at it than I am, regardless of what nationality the name is from.
I'm going to try my best to sound not at all like Pepe Le Pew, so yeah. If it happens, I apologize.
That's okay.
What's Le Cercle Rouge about, CJ?
Oh, geez, you want me to do this? Luckily, I have a synopsis here.
Let me read the let me read the epigraph, though. But
Okay.
Which kind of governed the entire, I guess, like, the film, the circle of the film. The beginning of the film opens with a quote. Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, drew a circle with a piece of red chalk and said, "When men, even unknowingly, are to meet one day, whatever may befall each, whatever the diverging paths, on the said day, they will inevitably come together in the red circle." So the film opens with this, and it kind of governs the film in general, especially considering like the group of characters and I'm going to let you go into the plot.
Okay, sure. Well, I'm just going to read what I have here. So,
okay.
Fate brings recent parolee Corey and fugitive Vogel together for a jewelry heist in Paris. The two men recruit ex-policeman Jansen to fill out their crew for the job, and the men are pursued by police inspector Mate, who was disgraced when Vogel escaped his custody, and must recapture him in order to keep his badge. Also on their trail is Rico, a mobster from Marseille who wants Corey dead. Seeking help, the trio turn to well-connected Santee, a Parisian nightclub owner and friend of Vogel's, not knowing that he is a potential informer to Mate. This all leads, of course, to an ill-fated conclusion.
I guess that's the movie in a nutshell.
It really is. It really is. That's a hallmark of like French crime movies, though, is that they're very fatalistic. You know, like the 30s gangster movies and the film noir movies. It does not usually end up well for the protagonist.
Yeah, I think the nihilism of a lot of these crime films is actually pretty similar to, say, 50s and 60s Japanese swordplay films.
Okay. I was really looking forward to sort of your take on this, because I look at it through a lens of film noir and classic Hollywood, and I knew that you would have sort of a different take, and I really want you to go with that, you know, because these guys, one of the things I like about it is that they sort of lead solitary lives. You know, there's, sorry ladies, there's no female characters to speak of, and there's no wives or
there's some of them.
Yeah. Well, there's some dancing girls. There is a bar owner that Mate talks to at one point, and there is an ex-girlfriend of Corey's who doesn't have a single line of dialogue. So, like, no woman in the picture has a line of dialogue, I don't think, in the whole movie. So it's really a masculine world. But it's important to point out, like, for people who haven't seen this or don't know a lot about French crime movies, that these are not gangsters, although Rico is, but our main characters are not gangsters. And I think that's an important point, because they're sort of independent contractors, you know, like they're highly skilled professionals in what they do, you know. And it reminds me of like the French equivalent of Ronin. And I think there's no coincidence that Melville titled his prior film with Alain Delon, Le Samurai, you know, because I think that's definitely an influence. And, you know, whatever you have to spill on that is very much welcome.
I think when a lot of people think of samurai cinema, they think of, you know, Akira Kurosawa, and there's like a heavy tendency with other directors, like, you know, like Mikio Naruse, to kind of like romanticize like the samurai period. There are a lot of ideas about chivalry, honor, not unlike, you know, the Western ideal of like knights in England. But there was definitely a movement in the 50s, 60s, and in the 70s, around the time when Melville was active, where you see like a fatalistic, nihilistic take that begins to emerge in their period pictures, ostensibly, which in many cases turn into crime films. You will have modern day, especially post-war films from directors like Kinji Fukasaku, who most people will probably know from Battle Royale, Tora, amongst other things.
Okay.
That tend to be a little bit more gritty.
I've seen both of those, by the way. Just want to point that out.
Yeah.
Seen Battle Royale and Tora.
Yeah. Where was I? Okay.
Sorry. Okay. I feel like Captain America, like getting the Wizard of Oz reference right there. I got that.
But then you'd have films like immediately the film series that comes to mind. There's a sword play series starring Raizo Ichikawa called Nemuri Kyoshiro, also known in the West as the Sleepy Eyes of Death.
Yeah.
It's about a swordsman who kind of wanders around, and he's a very aloof ladies man who kind of finds himself in situations where he needs to outsmart corrupt government officials, organize crime. But in many cases, he's not actually, he's more of an anti-hero. But like his nihilistic view of the world, it's probably one of the most famous Ichikawa. A lot of people compared him to James Dean, who's a handsome guy, except, you know, he had a much larger filmography than James Dean, but he also died. Like young. So he's got kind of like a legacy that's bordering on legendary.
Sure. A mystique about it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's,
Oh, go ahead.
No, what you mentioned, you know, that he sort of like outsmarts like criminals and officials and things like that. And just it immediately reminded me of like Yojimbo.
Yojimbo, though, I mean, he's a guy who kind of has trust in what's going to happen later.
Yeah.
Kyoshiro, he kind of, he'll do what he does, but he doesn't really care if, like, say he kills a daimyo and leaves like that fiefdom in shambles because of it. You know, a lot of times he'll do something, he'll stop like whatever's the immediate like danger, but then, you know, as a wanderer he'll leave, but then, you know, you can assume that like things like civil war and strife will like dominate that area, struggles for power will happen after him, but he's kind of like, it doesn't matter, you know, this is what I saw, so, you know, I take care of it. You know, he's got no responsibility after the fact.
Yeah.
Well, that's definitely a clear, like, opposite to a lot of times where, you know, you'll have, you know, a rightful ruler taking, taking back his land in, like, say, in some early Kurosawa films.
Okay.
Yep.
What, do you get a sense that Melville's drawing specifically on those types of pictures, though, when, you know, that's an influence on films like Le Samurai and Le Cirque Rouge?
You know, I think it's pretty tough to say. I think there's a long history of Franco-Japanese, like, relations. I'm not sure how far it extends culturally in terms of, like, film. There's definitely like an allure of Melville's work in Hong Kong film, most famously by a very famous proponent, John Woo, who is pretty instrumental in getting the film released uncut in the United States, where, you know, it previously until 2004, 2003, I believe, it always been released in like an edited, truncated version.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the 2003 restoration is what is Criterion source material for this, I think. So,
yeah. So John Woo, of course, famously took elements of Le Samurai into like his 1980s action masterpiece. I don't know. It's a really terrific film, but like the killer, Sammo Chai-Yun-Fat, and Danny Lee draws heavily on like elements of Le Samurai, you know, albeit in his heroic bloodshed subgenre of Hong Kong action film.
Yeah. 90s John Woo is the best John Woo.
Well, The Killer is like late 80s, so.
Same thing.
Yeah, maybe 1990. Maybe 1990. Man, not want to watch.
We'll go with that.
Yeah.
Cool. So, well, this was not my first time watching Le Cercle Rouge. It was your first time watching it.
First and second time.
Well, that, yeah, you watched it twice, but, you know, thinking back 2 weeks when you watched it the first time, like, you know, what was your initial impression?
It's a pretty mesmerizing film. A lot of the quiet moments, you know, I think definitely you need to be in a position where you can focus on the film. So, like, for me, I tend to watch a lot of, like, the movies we discuss late in the evening, you know, usually sometime after midnight and 2 a.m. when, you know,
everybody else is in bed.
Everything's quiet. It's dark outside. No glare from anything to possibly interrupt me.
Yeah, that's definitely my favorite, you know, way to watch a movie at home is late at night, you know, when it's even quiet outside and, you know, I have complete control over the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. So the quiet elements, you know, I think for a lot of people may seem boring or bothersome. But for me, in this instance, considering the film, I was pretty mesmerized by it. You know, you have a lot of cool camera shots, great photography. You know, the soundtrack never really struck me as being strong. It's mostly kind of like a muted film. But you know, you have cool hats, cool trench coats. There's a style that exists in it that you really don't see in a lot of other crime films, I think. Not until, like, you know, much later, or ones that are heavily influenced by this type of film.
Yeah, and the whole trench coat fedora type thing comes definitely from, you know, from early Hollywood pictures. So, yeah, which is funny, and this is not necessarily related to Le Cercle Rouge, but I always think it's funny that the, you know, when people think of film noir, they think of that overcoat and fedora, but that actually, like, there's so few film noir that actually feature that type of aesthetic. Typically, that comes from Bogart's detective stories, you know, whether it be mostly The Big Sleep, not even The Maltese Falcon. But people ascribe it, you know, to film noir. But in any case, you know, Melville loved it, and he certainly has embraced that whole sort of like beige trench coat thing, which is also a part of Le Samurai and Le Deuxième Souffle, if I'm saying that right. So, I hope I am. So, I don't want to get it wrong.
It's a damn good look.
It is. It is. And it's, you mentioned, you know, the technical aspects of the film. It's definitely a solid technical film. There's a precision to it. But like I found with maybe one exception that the camera work and the editing is kind of invisible. Like it's not showy at all. You know, the color palette is muted, like you mentioned. You know, it's almost shot like black and white film. It just happens to be in color. I thought there were a couple of nice transitions. I made a note of two of them. In the early train scene, they use Matei's eyeline to anticipate a cut to Vogel. So he's sort of looking over towards Vogel, which I believe is screen right. And when Melville makes the cut, he actually changes POV and location, but uses a matching cut of Corey in prison. So it was a really, like, beautiful transition, I thought. And the other one that I thought was really cool was the final shot in Jansen's apartment, where he opens up the closet that used to contain the quote-unquote beasts, and he uses the complete blackness inside the closet, and he pushes the camera in on it and then transitions into Matei's apartment. So, you know, Jensen happens to be the former policeman and Matei is the inspector on their trail. And I just thought it was really, you know, nice that he kind of transitioned from that former cop into the you know, from one cop's apartment to the other at that point.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really a lot of dynamic camera movement, like, in this film, but when it does happen, it's pretty, I guess it's pretty affecting.
Yeah, it's not like watching, like a Hitchcock movie or a David Fincher movie or something where you're constantly noticing the camera work. It, quite the opposite. It's just as laid back and understated as the characters and the world that they occupy in the film. Were you surprised at how most of the film takes place silently?
No, well, I mean, the film, before even seeing the film, there's a reputation specifically of the, like, the heist. So I was aware that even before watching the film that, like, for instance, like, the heist was a film or was a sequence in the movie that doesn't use any dialogue. It may be like there's like one or two words that exist within like a 30-minute period. So I was honestly expecting, like, I was expecting that, honestly. I think that it was going to be mostly like a visual storytelling.
Yeah, he's a show-don't-tell filmmaker, definitely. I think, you know, one of the things I did not specifically remember it being so silent. When I went to rewatch the movie, I was really, I don't know if taken aback is the right way to phrase it, but I was really surprised by how silent Vogel's story is. Like, Vogel doesn't say a single word, I don't think, until he meets Corey, which is like 40 minutes into the film. But he is a major part. He's one half of the story up until that point.
Yes.
So he gets on the train with Matei. You know, they spend a lot of time kind of setting up his breakout. So that, you know, they chase him through a meadow and through a stream. And we're going to come back to that because I think Melville's sense of humor comes out in those scenes. But he essentially ends up in the trunk of Corey's car. I honestly I would have to go back and rewatch it, like, specifically to listen for this, but I don't think he has a single word of dialogue until he meets Corey, which is just amazing because you learn a lot about him, you know, about his resourcefulness and, just, you know, the idea that there's such a massive manhunt for him after he escapes that he's got to be some type of major criminal. Yeah. Yet later in the film, he tells Corey, he's adamant about the fact that he's not a professional, that he's an amateur. I think it's tough to tell because maybe there's something lost in the translation or maybe Melville just doesn't care. You're not sure why he's arrested in the first place. He's just, quote unquote, a criminal.
Yes.
But
you can assume, though, like, I mean, he's done something. I mean,
well, there's a throwaway line by, like, one of Matei's other police officers to him, something about him being like a terrorist.
He says he's not a terrorist.
Right. He says he's no terrorist.
They're not going to put up roadblocks if he's not a terrorist. He's being escorted by Matei, though. So, I mean, who they establish later on as having like an exemplary police record.
Yeah.
So you can assume that, like, him being attached to this detail requires, you know, a certain, like, level of, maybe not, renown's not the right word, but I guess a lot of trust for him to be in charge or to be put as opposed to, like, a low level officer.
Right. Well, and Matei even says at one point that he's an intelligent prey, that his hunter's instinct says that they won't capture him right away. So.
He's brilliant, though. Plays the long game.
Oh yeah, you mean Matei?
Yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah. He's cunning. Yeah, that's for sure.
Played by Andre Beauville. Yes. Oh, we haven't really said names of actors for these characters yet.
Well, you know, I mean, you just said Andre Beauville.
Yes.
As Matei. Vogel is. I'm gonna butcher this. Gian Maria Volonté, and Alain Delon is Corey. Yves Montand is Jansen, and he's amazing. He's my favorite character.
Absolutely.
I love Jansen.
He's absolutely compelling, and I think, like, you know, the movie's a pretty quiet film, but there's definitely a lot of character that's revealed through his actions in the film.
Yeah.
So, and I think he's got a very interesting arc, despite not being introduced until like an hour into.
Well, he's the only one with a personal, not professional stake in it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he suffers from paranoid delusions and a crippling fear. And when he gets the call to be a part of the crew, miraculously, he's able to sort of pull himself out of that. In fact, like the one scene I think that just doesn't hold up for me in the movie is that first introduction, that nightmarish scene with Jansen, with the fake spiders. It's so terrible. It really is.
I think like those fake spiders look pretty bad, but I definitely think that would, you know, if you're someone with arachnophobia, that'd be much more chilling, I think, because I mean I don't suffer from that, but I could tell even if they're fake spiders, people being creeped out.
Yeah, these look like marionette spiders, though. Yeah, they're horrible. That scene should be cut out entirely. I hate that scene. But I do like how the wallpaper in his room is all like vertical stripes, which sort of like represents the prison of fear that he resides in. Like, you know, it's so like that's I think that's part of Melville's sense of humor there.
Well, he's a character that you mentioned personal stakes. Like he, you know, when he gets the call from Corey initially, it's a total stranger. Stuff happens quick. It's like, you know, people.
Well, but I guess Corey's using Vogel's name, and they knew each other, so yes. Like they have a connection at least.
He doesn't say Vogel's name. He says a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
A friend recommended you to me, or something like that. I can't remember the exact subtitle translation for it. What he's calling in the phone booth, which is, you know, rare and rarer in films.
Well, this was 1970.
Yes.
Phone booths were everywhere. Just ask Superman.
Oh, yeah. Superman's fast. He never needed phone booths anyway.
he used a shit ton of them, though.
It's a good look. Whatever.
Anyway. But yeah, Jensen's like my favorite. Like, after the introduction in his apartment when he, you know, is a wreck, the next time we see him is in the nightclub, and Melville does this amazing thing where he sort of introduces him again a second time by having the camera focus on his feet as he comes down the steps. Yes. And then he sort of pulls back and up so that you see how together he looks. Like, he's cleaned up, he's well dressed, he looks confident. Like, it's a really great moment for him. Mm-hmm. And then of course during the heist, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit, but that moment for him in the heist where he just pulls the rifle off the tripod and like Corey and Vogel are like, what is going on? And then he just nails the fucking shot. He just nails it.
Yeah. That's cool. That's definitely a scene that's been recreated in Hard Boiled with Chow Yun-Fat.
Mm.
There's a sequence where like, you've seen Hard Boiled. Yeah.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. There's like a scene where Chow Yun-Fat's character and Tony Leung's character are both trapped underneath where there's an armory underneath the hospital. In order to get out, Chow Yun-Fat loads gunpowder into a pipe and then attempts to shoot a bullet that's lodged inside the pipe to blow it up in order to open the door.
Right.
So he misses initially because of nerves, but then, you know, he does kind of like a quick draw, like, you know, pistol at his side, shakes that off, and it does a like quick like lift up shot similar to like similar to Jansen's shot when he picks that rifle up off of the tripod.
Nice. I actually don't remember that, so I guess I have to rewatch Hard Boiled sometime soon.
Well, you know, Wu definitely does a couple like instances where he does zoom in on like the little, instead of like the keyhole, he zooms in on like the back of a bullet. Very similar to the scene that we're discussing. Yeah.
Cool.
And once they get in, you know, like you talk about the personal stakes of Jansen. There's the moment where He brings a flask. He smells it, but he feels he doesn't need it anymore. So I think the film has the idea of Jansen needing a purpose. And for whatever reason, he left the police. I don't believe that they ever, give an actual reason. They just kind of keep his background in mystery. He's fallen onto these hard times because of, whatever reason, like the fact that he's got a purpose, even though it's like an illicit purpose, is something that kind of saves him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's my favorite. Like during the heist, when Corey and Vogel have to like break in and, they're doing all these careful movements and going up and down like these like rope ladders and in and out, breaking windows, and Melville like cross cuts to Jansen's apartment, and he just gets ready, just like, like he would if he was going to like a dinner, and he just like puts on his tuxedo and, gets his coat on and grabs an umbrella and walks down the street, and people pass him and he doesn't care, and they cut back and forth, and just every time he gets a little bit closer and they get a little bit closer to needing him, and finally he just shows up and just kind of like, does his thing, and then as they're getting all the loot, he just leaves. He just walks out. It's awesome. Oh, I love it. But yeah, the heist you mentioned all takes place silently. It's really an ode to Rififi, which I know is something that you haven't seen yet. You really need to watch that. It is the greatest heist movie of all time, I think.
Oh, I do own a Criterion copy of it.
Yeah. Well, we should let some time pass and then do an episode on Rififi, because that movie is just the bomb. I love that movie.
Is that going to be your choice upcoming?
Yeah, maybe like a year from now. Well, we're doing this movie, and then we're doing Blade Runner next week, to coincide with the release of Blade Runner 2049. So, like, we've already done, like, we did the Maltese Falcon, we did the Hustler. We've done a lot of, like, noirish crime films.
Well, I mean,
we need to start diversifying a little bit.
Good.
I mean, I'm happy to keep doing them. That's my thing, but...
Well, I mean, it is October, so after Blade Runner, maybe do some horror films.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely.
Yeah. I guess we can discuss which ones we're gonna do.
Yeah, well, we could do that off. We don't need that right now.
But for the listeners, if you have a suggestion, let us know. You're gonna have to get your suggestions in soon, though, because we are ready. We are, as of today, this is the October the 2nd. So.
Yep. We were talking about the heist, and I mentioned Rififi. I also wanted to take a quick note. The masks that they wear during the burglary is very reminiscent of Kansas City Confidential, which is also another good film noir heist movie where the majority of the story takes place after the heist is over. That's one of the things about this particular film, and I think Rififi falls into the same category too. When you talk about heist movies in America, most of the time there's an elaborate setup to the whole thing. There's a lot of talking about the plan, and essentially, most American filmmakers use those scenes to sort of set up an audience expectation, and then they spend the next however long in the movie like just tearing that expectation down and throwing obstacles in the way of the characters, and to great effect. I mean, I'm not downplaying great American heist movies, because there are many. If you go backwards in time, Asphalt Jungle is another one. I mentioned Kansas City Confidential. If you go forward in time, there's Thief with James Caan, Ocean's 11. There's a ton of them. But Melville doesn't waste time on setting up a plan. There's a scene where Jansen goes in and cases the jewelry shop, and they spend a good amount of time, just showing how the security works in the place, and then he sort of reports back to them. But there's no like montage scene where it's like, okay, you're gonna do this and you're gonna do that and you're gonna do this and I'm gonna do that, and then ruin it later.
Yeah, everyone just knows what they need to do.
Right, they're pros.
They establish early on that like the prison guard has his own plan for it, like you know his own setup for it.
Right. That's that fucking prison guard. You know, these movies really depend on the interconnectivity of the underworld.
Yeah. There's a reputation. I mean, like, if for a recent example, you know, you have, like, the underworld of, like, the assassin world of, like, John Wick, which is a pretty popular recent example.
Absolutely. And a good one. And a good one.
It's below what people know, but very much it's, you know, a living, breathing entity almost.
Yeah. I think the second one spends too much time sort of like going overboard with the whole world of John Wick.
The mystique of it in the first film is one of the best parts of...
Absolutely, yeah. I think the first one strikes a good balance. The second one, I think, tips the scale, and I'm not as much of a fan of that. Although I still... The action scenes are great, and I like Keanu in it. But yeah, that is a good example of sort of like just being this whole another world that people don't realize is there. And Melville only concerns himself with that world in this movie. I'm not an expert on like French crime films in any way, shape or form, but a lot of the 1950s policier films are really about criminal characters, and they don't concern themselves with people who are not part of the world at all. So there's not a lot of family members. There's not a lot of bystanders, you know, or people who are tangential to what's happening. You know, they really focus on the core group of people who live and breathe in that world.
Yeah, definitely. I was just trying to think. I mean, characters who don't exist within that world are, yeah, maybe the guy who owns the billiard hall.
Yeah. Well, you see them.
Yeah. I'm just trying
but
to think.
They're not real flesh and blood characters.
The guy's at least got a line, though.
Well, see, that scene's great. You want to talk about, like, let's talk about Corey for a second, because we really, like, I've been gushing about Jensen, because I love him in this. But, like, the way Melville and Alain Delon work together is pretty awesome. And, like...
He's cool as shit.
He really is. Like, two of my favorite things actually happen really early in the movie with him. And the first one is, after he gets out of prison, you know, he cleans himself up, he makes his way, you know, into Marseille, and he goes to see Rico. And he gets out of the elevator, and you know he's got a purpose, but he just kind of strolls along. He gets out of the elevator, and he's kind of looking around. His arms are in his pockets, and he doesn't have a care in the world. Like, he, you know, I can't explain it other than to say it's just fucking cool. And the shot is actually a little bit of a low angle shot, so you know, so it's like you're looking up at him a little bit, which makes it even more cool. So, and then in that pool room scene that you mentioned, you know, he essentially beats one guy over the head with the pool stick. The other guy pulls out a gun and he just sort of like pushes the guy's arm over so that he shoots. So one bad guy shoots the other bad guy in the head. And then he beats that guy up quickly, and then he just walks out of the place. He just kind of strolls out. And as he does, the pool room guy gets on the phone, and he's like, police, police. And he just sort of like stops and pauses for a second, and then just coolly turns around and like yanks the phone cord out of it. And then leaves again.
Then he walks out to the street. Lights a cigarette and walks off.
Right. It's just like, he could not give a fuck about what other people are doing. He doesn't care.
I mean, you talked about earlier when he goes to Rico's room or apartment. Like, he doesn't have a gun, doesn't have anything. He goes in there, grabs a gun, steals his money. and guess, you know, you assume that, like, his...
But you could tell Rico is intimidated. Yeah, Rico's absolutely. Rico's the gangster with resources who has the power, quote-unquote, and he, you know, when Corey shows up at his door, he's sweating it. So, like, I mean, that definitely says something about the character of Corey. You know, what kind of a man he is. And then the way he handles himself in the pool room, there you go. Speaking of that scene where he goes to see Rico, this is in his 2003 review of the movie, Roger Ebert referred to Le Cirque Rouge as a ballet of crime. So, which I thought was a great little soundbite. I can't think of a more suitable description, actually. A great example of that is the way Corey moves around the room when he visits Rico. And he, like, Rico's talking and trying to sort of, like, buy time and get rid of him. And Corey's just kind of like, it's like almost like he's tuning Rico out. Like, he's listening, but he knows he's going to get what he wants in the end. And he glides around the apartment, and there's a tease because his ex-girlfriend is now Rico's girl. And she's in the bedroom, and she hears his voice and goes to the door, buck naked, you know, which is very French. And she sort of, like, puts her hand up on the door, and she's, like, listening. And Corey, like, strolls around to the bedroom door and just kind of, like, leans over towards it. And he pauses, and he thinks twice, and then he doesn't open the door. And, like, that's one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie. Like, you know, it's almost like the past to him doesn't matter. You know, it's
not
only
anymore. I think, you know, there's a possibility that maybe he thought he could, you know, pick up from where he left off. But, like, you know, the scene when he takes the money out of the safe, he, you know, he tosses the pictures of his ex-girlfriend, which are one of the few things he, you know, he gets back once he leaves prison.
Yeah, but he didn't want it, remember? Like, he actually leaves the picture there, and one of the prison guards is like, here, take your picture, and he sort of, like, gives him a double take and then sticks it in his pocket.
No, he tosses it back into the safe after he takes it.
Afterwards, yeah, yeah. Well, and then when he gets back to his real apartment in Paris, he throws her picture in the trash can, first thing. That's the first thing he does. Mm-hmm. Fuck that girl.
Lines.
Yeah, you don't even have any dialogue. You're sleeping with Rico. Fuck you.
Yeah, Corey should have hooked up with the lady that gave him the rose.
All right, here, listen. The bromance between Corey and Vogel is amazing in this movie. Like, they're like.
You know, there definitely is, like, a strong undercurrent of maybe kind of, like, subtle homoeroticism that exists.
There totally is.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the rose. Like, when they first meet, Corey knows that Vogel's in the trunk of his car. He drives into this empty field in the middle of nowhere and tells Vogel it's safe to get out. He knows he's the guy that they're talking about on the radio who escaped the police custody. And, you know, so they have their little, you know, tete-a-tete, they're feeling each other out. But the way Melville shoots the thing, it's like a romantic comedy. It's like a meet-cute. It's so weird. It's bizarre. I love it, though. Like after they talk and Corey, like, flips him the cigarettes and then the lighter, and then, like, Vogel knows, okay, I can put the gun away. You know, we're cool. And then as he's, like, lighting up the cigarette, Melville, like, he has these matching shots that are straight on. They're not profile. They're straight on to each actor, and they push in, like, each one of them. And then after that, there's, like, this weird panning shot as they both sort of look around the field. It's just, it's so bizarre. It's so great, though. Like, I literally, like, when I was rewatching the movie, I didn't remember it being that awkward. So, like, I actually, like, rewound it and watched that scene again. Like,
you know, they both gotta, like, enjoy their cigarettes. Not like, you know, Volga can smoke while he's in the trunk, right?
He does, though. He takes a cigarette in with him, which is awesome too. Like, you need to blow up the car.
Just imagine him on his back smoking, blowing straight up into his own face.
But that's just the beginning, though. Like, it's like their relationship is incredible and odd and yes, homoerotic in a way. Like later in the film, when they go back to Corey's apartment and Corey is saying that he's going to go pick up Jensen, but Vogel needs to stay there. That whole scene feels like they're two lovers saying goodbye to me.
Yeah.
Does it not?
I think there are elements of it too. But well, I think
after like, Corey leaves, like Vogel picks up a rose and watches him leave the building through the window with a rose in his hand.
Would you prefer him to like put his hand out?
I'm glad they don't go that far, but like it's so obvious that they're like there's. I mean, you know, there was a professional respect initially, but there was also like a, I don't know, like both of these guys are just attracted to the other. And I don't necessarily mean that in a sexual way, although I think that there is part of that as well. They're just like, they click in a way that just feels strange for a movie like this, but yeah, I think it's awesome.
It's like, it's weird that, you know, like if they had met each other beforehand, they would have been like partners for a long time. You know?
Yeah, They're BFFs forever.
Yeah.
Until they get mowed down at the end.
Yeah, well, together in death, I guess.
Right, absolutely. They'll meet again in the Red Circle.
Hey, I mentioned earlier about John Woo and like the heroic bloodshed genre of films. That's a very common trait, you know, like existing admiration, especially within like people in the underworld criming, you know, like romance, I guess is the term that people use these days, but
yeah,
like, you know, like two men kind of finding a friendship that's stronger, but they're thrown together, but the bond that they develop over the course of a film tends to be much stronger than like, say, like friendships that they may have had outside of like these extreme situations.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's when you're under that much pressure and you know, you can rely on somebody, there's just a bond that happens. It's
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean that happens between soldiers and policemen and firemen and things like that too. It's just, you know, it's just for me, I think it's just the way Melville stages and shoots those scenes though, in many cases, like when
it also happens between like cowboys too. Like,
yeah, apparently. Just ask Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I cut you off. I just wanted to make a Brokeback Mountain joke.
you successfully made it. Don't worry. So what else?
I don't know, man. I mean, the movie's pretty damn good.
Well, there's two things. One, I wanted to bring up what I think is a prime example of Melville's sense of humor, which is not as overt as, say, like Hitchcock's sense of humor or something like that. When you're talking about you know, that dark humor that gets interwoven into serious films, but like, you know how they say crime is a dirty business? Well. I think it's hilarious that like Vogel, like once he escapes custody of Matei, he's got to jump through a glass window to escape. He runs through like this, you know, like through like the woods, basically like dirt, leaves, mud. He strips down to his underwear and crosses a stream to throw off like the hounds that are chasing him before running through more mud. And then inexplicably it starts snowing, so he's running through the snow. And then he like jumps into the trunk of Corey's car. He's in the trunk for a while, you know, and then Corey brings him out, and where are they? They're in like a muddy like field. You know, the car's muddy, they're both muddy. He gets back in the trunk with a cigarette. Somewhere in there they get out and he kills the two guys, which is a cool scene too, because he automatically, you know, instinctively kills them with each other's guns. And then finally when he gets out of the trunk for good, what happens? He steps right through a puddle in front of Corey's apartment. Like, I don't know if it's just me. Just it's all right if it's just me, but I think that's hilarious. Like,
well, you know, that scene also does coincide with like Matei leaving, leaving his discussion with the police chief.
Yeah.
So he mentions that he hasn't slept in 48 hours.
Right.
So I mean, you know, Vogel obviously is, you know, on last legs, I imagine.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I think he borrows some of Corey's clothes, I guess, because like I guess the next morning Corey's in his suit and like Vogel's in like some pajamas. So, who knows what happened?
Who knows what happened that night, man?
Right, exactly. And then, sorry. Did you have something you wanted to add?
No, not specifically. I feel like we've enjoyed this conversation, but to be honest, I'm not sure if there's anything else I could add. Definitely we mentioned earlier that our dynamic is that you over prepare and I under prepare. So
that's okay. I don't mind. The only other thing that I had in my notes that we didn't really touch on was you mentioned Matei coming out of the internal affairs inspector's office. That scene, I think, is really important to perhaps Melville's own worldview. The whole speech that the guy gives Matei about how all men are guilty, even policemen, you know, it's not something he contradicts in the film. It's something he confirms with the film. You know, I mean, Jansen's a former policeman, and he's in on the crew for the heist. You know, the prison guard, the corrections officer that tips Corey off to the heist, is supposed to be, you know, a good guy, but he's corrupt. And even Matei uses some questionable methods to get results throughout the picture, you know, like abducting Santee's son, you know, as a way to maintain leverage on him and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And even when Santee's son, does he die? He does die, right?
No, I don't think so. He kind of passes out and then like they call an ambulance, but then like you don't see his son again.
Yeah, you're not sure, but like, I don't know. For whatever reason, I got the impression that he died.
You could have him throw up. You can just have him throw up his, you know, whatever it said, aspirin or something, right? Overdose on aspirin.
It's vague, but like, in any case, like something bad happens to his kid, and Matei's just like, yeah, whatever. Like, we need to move this along because I need to catch these guys. So, you know, I mean, there really are no good guys, and our you know, the people that we're rooting for are all criminals. So. I think that conversation that they have, which again comes up at the end after they kill everybody, the inspector shows up and says, I think he just simply says, "All men, Matei, all men."
I told you so moment.
Yeah, I mean that is the movie in a nutshell. Like, you know, that there is, you know, there, I guess Melville's an original sin kind of guy. Like that's he doesn't believe in the goodness of humanity.
Well, I mean, you know, his movies wouldn't be interesting otherwise. I guess.
Yeah. Who could blame him? I guess with the life he lived, although he was, you know, a successful filmmaker, but
who knows what he did to get there.
I guess. I don't know. I didn't do that much research. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that was good.
Yeah, I think so. I think we definitely shook off the cobwebs once we got into the movie.
Yeah, just wait till Blade Runner next week. It'll be awkward all over again.
Well, you know, probably not as awkward as you think.
I'm just kidding. No, it was Blade good. Runner.
Plus, it's Blade Runner too, man. We could both talk about this movie for forever.
I could talk about Blade Runner for a while. Although I think some of my views on Blade Runner might surprise you, even though you know that I love the movie. I'm certainly going to be acknowledging some of its flaws big time.
Well, I mean, you can't love something and not acknowledge its flaws, you know.
Usually, the movies that I love are the ones that are flawed, that I love in spite of the flaws. So it's a lot of times the perfect movies are movies that I don't necessarily want to rewatch all that often.
Like, what's an example of that?
You're really putting me on the spot here. We're gonna parking lot that. We'll revisit that next week when we talk about Blade Runner.
Okay.
I'll have a couple examples for you.
Oh yeah.
So, but yeah. So for anybody who's listening, we'll be doing Blade Runner next week, and at that point, Blade Runner 2049 will have been released. So we were going to just do an episode specifically on Blade Runner by itself. But I imagine that some Blade Runner 2049 will bleed in. I'm super excited for it. The reviews that started to surface this week have been extremely positive. And, you know, it's hard, you know, any time hyperbole starts to come out and people start talking about new movies as masterpieces, I sort of roll my eyes a little bit sometimes. Because you know, I think you really need some distance to determine the quality of a film, but
yeah, to see if it stands the test of time.
Yeah, but I'm encouraged by all the positivity surrounding this film, and a lot of people have been comparing this late era Blade Runner sequel to Mad Max Fury Road as far as like just like a jolt of new energy to a franchise. So I'm psyched.
I hope so. We'll see if Sony can rebound off of this.
Is it Sony?
Isn't it Sony? Sony and Warner Brothers, right?
Well, maybe. I don't know.
I could have swore it was Sony, because I remember I thought it was weird that it was Sony. So.
Well, you might be right. It's, you know, I thought it was Warner Brothers, though, because they put out the original movie. But
yeah.
We'll find out.
The anime?
I haven't yet. I did watch the other two shorts, the one with Jared Leto and the one with Dave Bautista. Mm-hmm. So I'll watch the anime prequel as well. You haven't watched them?
No.
Okay. They're not going to be necessary, I don't think. This is kind of like they're doing exactly what like the Animatrix did, I think.
Okay. Maybe so, I'll just do it after. Yeah. I'll watch them after I watch the movie.
Yeah, they're just giving you a little bit of background. I think it more than anything, I think it was a way to tease people and help build anticipation.
Yeah, cool.
So,
not that I need to be teased much more.
No, but, well, and we'll get into this more next week, but I mean, Blade Runner really was not a success when it came out, and it became a cult film in the 90s, and then more of a mainstream success in the 2000s after the Final Cut came out. So like general audience goers, there's still a lot of people who don't like Blade Runner. Like it just doesn't connect with some people. Sure. So I think, you know, this is a $150 million sequel. It was a gamble for them to put that much money into this movie. So I hope it pays off for them, and I hope audiences embrace it and make it a hit. But I guess we'll find out next week. So until then, where can people find you online, Cesar?
Well, you can find me at filmsmash.com. I just actually put up a review for Sleepy Eyes of Death number 4, which nice. I discussed a bit of that series earlier today. Or on Twitter at juniorvho.com. No, not a com.
.com. At Junior Beho, got it. And for myself, you can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame. And currently, I am rethinking my digital home online. I have a Letterboxd account that I am currently kind of keeping track of my movies on.
I just started using Letterboxd again.
I know that. I'm following you.
The pain in the ass.
I think it's really easy to use, actually.
No, I just hate that, like, I've seen so many movies, but I only have, like, 50 in there right now.
Well, I'm only doing, like, them as I watch them. So, like, yeah. I've only put in the stuff I've watched this year.
Yeah, me too. So that's why I only have, like, that bit.
Yeah, I only have, like, 140 or 150 movies on there right now.
Yeah, the app on the phone is not very user-friendly,
so,
I think.
If you take the time to find me on Letterboxd, it's under CJ Talbot, or you can find it at Setting the Frame, because Letterboxd and Twitter are linked up for me. I have seven pieces on Hitchcock's first seven silent films that I did put up there. So if you're interested in the silent filmmaking of Alfred Hitchcock, please stop by and like and comment on those reviews. Otherwise, just stay tuned, and we'll have more celluloid jelly for you.
Yeah, guys, thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much, and Cesar, I will talk to you next week.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. None of those companies are actual sponsors.